Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with someone you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
So after the draft, there was about six teams that called up and were interested in inviting me as a free agent. Eagles were one of them. So, I basically asked the coaches. I said, how many linebackers do you keep? What kind of defense do you run? And they said, aren't you just happy for the opportunity? I said, no, I'm intending to make your football team. I need to know what's my best opportunity.
And our guest this week, Mike Reichenbach. He is a former Eagles linebacker, was a key part of some really good defenses with the Eagles back in the 80s. And Mike, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
So first off, what are you doing these days?
Well, you know, when you walk away from playing at a higher level like that, and you have to integrate back into the working world. I mean, back then we didn't make the kind of money they're making now. So people are surprised that you have to actually go back out into the work world and work. So I basically, a couple things happened late in my career. I had a life change, you know, I became a Christian, changed what I did and got involved in youth ministry, but still had to go to work and support the family because I was I got married at the end of my career and had a new father actually as I retired and walked away. My last year I was in San Francisco and that was my ninth season. So walked away and, you know, pretty much, you know, as a ex-NFL player, the one thing you can do is sell. So I picked up a newspaper and started looking at ads for selling, you know, went out in interviews and took a position in a job in sales and worked in youth ministry within our church. And, you know, God just started to move in my life and just opened up other doors and kept progressing in sales. So now I work in the packaging industry, and I'm a sales director for a company, and we print labels for pharmaceuticals. So all that good stuff you buy in the store, I print the labels for that. So and all that literature that you throw away that has all the directions on it, I print that too. We print that too. So
how, you mentioned the end of your career, how difficult was giving up football? Because I know a lot of times that is really tough for people because it's so much of your identity, who you are. How difficult was it for you, or was your body, your mind telling you it was time?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you asked that because there's a lot of guys that are usually you're forced out of the game. You don't have that option. It's usually you want to hang on and play as long as you can. At least that when we played, that was the case. But there's some guys that their bodies forced them out of the game. I actually had the choice. I chose to walk away because it was one of those things that, like you had just mentioned, it was my identity for a long time. It defined who I was. It kind of was, and so I was able to assess all that in light of a different, you know, the truth of God's word, and say, you know what, this isn't who I am. I can walk away from this. But I took the experiences with me because they were rich. I mean, just to be able to play at that level, play with a bunch of guys that I played with, that and have the opportunity to run out there and play for the fans and be a part of that, it was a great thing. But you see a lot of guys struggling now with that because that was the best life was for them. They kind of got stuck there, and that happens. But, you know, it's transitioning out of that and then being able to see. I mean, I tell people the best job I've ever had was being a husband and a father. You want to talk about challenging? It's even tougher than going to camp. You know that. I mean, anybody that's a husband or a father out there, or a mother, it's a tough job.
How much do you think your faith helped fill that void that was football for so long? Because if I'm understanding the timing, it sounds like you came to Christianity late in your career.
Yeah, it was about mid to second half of my career, but I was transitioning out of a world where I was one of the guys in the locker room that was knew everywhere to go and where to be and what was happening every night of the week and on the streets. Reggie White, I'll just give you a short story. Reggie White was signing autographs at a Christian function one time, and someone came and said, "Hey, Reggie, Mike Regemont comes to our church. He gave his life to Christ." And he stopped, signed, and looked up, and he went, "Yeah, right." And he had to call me up and say, "Mike, I have to apologize. You're the last guy I thought that would give your life to Christ, that would come to Christ." But yeah, it's about being what's central in your life, what defines who you are, what gives you significance, you know, what gives you security. Significance, what I talk about, your self-worth and what your purpose in life is. And for me, when I was a young kid, I mean, football, people say, "Did you love football?" I said, "Well, not really. I just was big enough and I could play it, and it got me accepted." And that was the thing that kind of defined me, because it gave you affirmation. It gave you kind of, you know, hey, you're okay. Here's Mike, the football player. And as I started to go up into high school and things like that, I started to gain more affirmation. But here's the problem. The guys that I hung with also, you know, started to party. And that became a part of that being accepted, was part of the partying at life too. If I could perform, I'm accepted. Oh yeah, and by the way, we party. And that ripple affected all the way into my adult life and kind of defined who I was. And when I came to the knowledge of the truth, you know, that I could be forgiven for my sin and to have a life that was, you know, what I was created for, was greatness for me. So I could walk away then. And it kind of redefined all of that in my life. So
was there a moment where it crystallized for you during your career where you kind of realized that you didn't like kind of what your life had become? That sounds harsh, but like, you know, all the ripple effects of what you were saying about the partying and stuff like that. Was there a moment where you looked in the mirror and said, "I need this, this is, can't continue"?
Yeah, it's when I got everything the world told me would pay it off and it didn't. You know, I remember when I was in high school, and a guy said to me, you know, my value system was really defined on Sunday afternoons, watching those guys on TV growing up going. And I remember a coach saying to me, "Listen, if you get to that place, you'll have all the answers." And here I was, when I was asking, you know, the questions I was asking myself, who am I? Well, what's life all about? And where do I go when I die? Because people close to me had died at the time. And I'm like, okay, what happens then? And everywhere I went and the higher I went, I still didn't get the answers. And then I finally made it to the highest you could go. And I went, this isn't it. And not until I walked into a Bible study and I heard that there was a God that created me and loved me and died for my sins, I said, you know, now I can understand what, you know, that foundation of why I'm a mess, why was I a mess? And it was when those, you had all that stuff and you still filled your life with it and still you were empty, you know. And I remember driving around in Center City, wee hours of the morning in a BMW, you know, playing in the NFL going, this isn't it. This isn't it. So I think it was a culmination of a lot of things going on in my life. All the valued relationships in my life were kind of train wrecked. You know, anything that was good was kind of because I had just immersed myself in that whole world, you know. So, it was a little bit of a long road.
Now, let's go back. You grew up in Bethlehem, correct?
Yeah, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, right up the road. They were all Eagle fans. And of course, when I was a young kid, I said, I wanted, because this course the Steelers were winning, so I was a Steelers fan. And all my uncles said, "How can you not be an Eagles fan?" I said, you know, just to get them kind of get them upset, I said, "If I ever make it to the NFL, I'll never play for the Eagles." So God has a sense of humor too.
And you play, growing up, it sounds like you played a lot of stuff. I think you were high level baseball, wrestling, and football. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I was. It's easy. It's funny how you say that. But I was, when I started Little League Baseball, they all said, the coach said, okay, everybody get out in the field. We're going to hit you some balls, see where you play. And they looked at me and they went, you stay here. You're going to be the catcher, because I was the biggest kid. So I started to catch, and it ended up being the best position you could play. So I played catching all the way up into high school. Wrestling, I kind of stumbled into as well. The football coach that I coached my high school team was also the wrestling coach. And he said, you know, I was about 195 pounds. He said, you know, you'd be good at wrestling. I go, would he said, we need a heavyweight. Well, I found out that the heavyweights are like 260. And so he just needed a wrestler. So I started wrestling, and that was, interesting. You learn leverage and things like that. But yeah, so I wrestled for a little bit there too. So,
but football was always top of the list?
Yeah, I think football is the one that I kind of played the longest and loved the most. But I wasn't highly recruited coming out of high school. I think I made city all-star. And I think if you'd ask any coach that coached me at that time, which guy they coached would make it to the NFL, I would have been the last name on the list. So,
were you playing linebacker in high school as well, or were you playing all over?
No, I was a defensive end and a tight end. When I went to college at East Stroudsburg, the coach talked me into playing. He wanted to make me a middle linebacker. And I remember going out on the field the first time and playing. And I said, coach, you got to move me back to end. I can't play this position. And he said, no, just hang in there. And so I did. And I'm glad he talked me into it.
Why East Stroudsburg? Were they one of the few schools that showed interest in you playing football? Or what was the connection that got you there?
Yeah, they were really the only school that really recruited me and brought me in and thought that I could have a chance to play there. So, yeah, it was there wasn't a lot of teams that were, you know, you didn't have the social media then, so you kind of had to promote yourself, but it was all game film. And, you know, they looked at who made it to states, and, you know, they looked at, you know, who made the all state team and the all American team, things like that. So I wasn't on any of those lists, but, you know, coach saw something in me that he gave me an opportunity.
How long did it take you to feel comfortable at linebacker? You talked about being overwhelmed there at first. Was it a couple practices, or are we talking like a season or a spring session that it took to really get your feet under?
Yeah, you get into the playing. I mean, you're in camp, you have 2 week camp, and within the camp, you know, you have do 2-a-days, of course, all pads. And just the coaching, the coach Denny Dowds was there. He was there for years. He's the defensive and linebacker coach. Just was a good coach and was patient with me. And within the 2 weeks, and then you come in. I mean, my freshman year back then, the great part about it then was they had JV teams. So it gave you time to learn. We played Army JVs. We went up to Army to play the JVs. And I think my first game, I had 18 tackles. And so then my second game, I had, you know, 18 or 19 tackles and then 2 interceptions. And they said, you know, maybe we need to move this guy up to a varsity. So my freshman year, I was actually suiting varsity and playing special teams. But still playing JV, which gave me a chance to learn the game. You know, see, I wasn't the greatest athlete, even in high school. And when I first came into 10th grade, I was 135 pounds, so I was a defensive back. Well, I can tell you this, I didn't have the speed to be a defensive back. And then my junior and senior year, my junior year, I went up to 165. My senior year, I went up to 195. They moved me to defensive end. But I always used to watch the game. I would watch good players play, and I would watch, you know, what they did on the field. I tell kids now, I said, most guys, if they don't start, they kind of just veg out and they're disgruntled because they're not starting. I said, that's when you watch good players, learn the game. It gives you an advantage when your opportunity comes to step on the field. So that's what I did. And you just learn the game and watch good players. And when he gave me the opportunity, I got it. And it just all came together. So my sophomore year, I actually started in college.
When did you start to think that professional football was a possibility? Because it does not sound like you have that normal where it was an inevitability. It was just a matter of where it was going to be. Like, when did you start to think, maybe I got a shot at this?
Really not to my senior year. My junior year, I had made honorable mention All-American. But then I got in some, it was after, I should say after my sophomore year, I came into it. But I had to take time off at school. I'd gotten some trouble, but got back in. And my junior year, I was honorable mention All-American. Then my senior year, I was first team All-American. And that's when I started to hear that you might have a shot at making to the NFL. So I didn't get invited to any of the combines or anything like that. But, you know, coaches would come in and time you. But I always say Stroudsburg was one of those places, again, because there wasn't social media. I'd say a college coach was driving by and needed gas, and he pulled off at the that exit and said, "Hey, there's a college here. Let's go see if there's any players."
Why were you good? Why do you think you were good? Because it doesn't sound like overwhelming physical traits, but was it just desire and understanding the game?
It was yeah, the mental part of the game and hard work. I mean, I connected with some guys, especially one guy at Stroudsburg. Ray Akavanis was his name. He had eyes on making it to the NFL. He was one of the guys that was big. He could run. He was a great athlete, played defensive end, and he actually got drafted by the Vikings, and he was a couple years ahead of me, but he couldn't stay healthy. He had a lot of injuries and things like that, so he never made the – he was always on the practice squad or the injured reserve, what they would call, I guess. But I started working out, and we just worked harder than everyone else. I mean, very focused, very purposeful – workouts where we would go to the track at, you know, 6 a.m. and run, you know, 10 220s and 880s and 440s. And you'd run as many as you could before your body's ready to give out. And you go, well, everybody's running that. We have to run 5 more. So we were just very focused. And actually, I even picked out the last guy on the, once I was knew I was going to the Eagles, the last linebacker on the Eagles roster, and said, that's the guy I got to beat. And every time I went out to work out, I had to use him to say he was running more than me. And then we would go to the gym and go there for 3 hours. And then at night, we'd go back to the track and do agility drills. So three times a day, I was working out. So
you don't get drafted, but you do sign with the Eagles. Where do the Eagles come in? Had they talked to you prior to the draft and said, we like you, and... You know, or was it a call after the draft, and it was the first contact that you had kind of directly with them?
Yeah, it was kind of the after the draft, because there, you know, again, they would send the scouts. There was scouts that would cover maybe 5 or 6 teams, so they might come in and run you, and you would basically then, you know, that information would go out to their teams that they represented, and so you didn't know who was really looking at you. I mean, I had heard, oh, I might get drafted late rounds, but I kind of knew the first day. Because back then the draft was 2 days. That after the first day, I just had a feeling I wasn't going to get drafted. So after the draft, there was about 6 teams that called up and were interested in inviting me as a free agent. Eagles were one of them. So I basically asked the coaches. I said, "How many linebackers do you keep? What kind of defense do you run?" And they said, "Aren't you just happy for the opportunity?" I said, "No, I'm intending to make your football team. I need to know what's my best opportunity." So people say, "Well, how did you end up in Philly?" And I said, "Well, they were the one that offered me a signing bonus, which could buy me a car, which could get me from Bethlehem to Philadelphia because I didn't have a car." Back then, the signing bonuses aren't what they are now. I think it was back then it was $5,000, which bought me at that time a Delta 88 diesel. So I got in my diesel and I drove to Philadelphia, and everybody else was pulling up in their BMWs and Mercedes, and I pulled up in my diesel, and they just said, "Who is this guy?"
You had mentioned earlier, like, you were the Steeler fan and everybody around you was Eagles fan. So how does this news ripple within your circle of family and friends and all that, you know, you're signing with the Eagles?
Well, they were just excited because they, you know, it was local. I was, they were just, actually, they were hoping I would make it so I could get them tickets to come to the games. That's what it was. So, and matter of fact, that's what happened. I have to get like 30 tickets a game for people coming down, because everybody, of course, is your relation or your friend at that time. But yeah, so it was great. I was grateful because my parents got to be able to come see me play, and my dad and my mom had shown and displayed a work ethic within our family that, you know, they gave us a home, they worked hard. They were kids when they first got married. They were 16, 17 and 19. They were kids raising kids, started having kids right away. My dad was a bricklayer. You know, he used to, when I got old enough, I would be his labor, and I would carry block and brick and mix cement. And I'd say, "Dad, I don't want to do this for a living." He'd say, "You know, you got to go to college." I said, "I don't know what college is, but I'm going." And they were able to be able to come see me play. So that was a blessing. So
you sign, and we're talking Marion Campbell, correct? Head coach?
Marion Campbell was the head coach. And we had a linebacker coach. His name was George Hill, and he coached with Woody Hayes. And if you want to talk fire and brimstone, he was Woody Hayes all through and through. But I'll tell you what, the technique and the things I learned from him were just astronomical. And back then, you know, every team had an incredible running back. You know, it was about controlling the clock, move the chains, you know, control the game. So you had a running back. There was still passing in a lot of it, not as much as now, of course, but every team had a premier running back because you knew you had to control the clock and move the ball. So you had to be able to, you know, our big thing was defeat the block, get off the block, go to the football. So the things that you learned there were just immeasurable. I mean, it just made you a better player, and the things that they invested in you. So good coaching staff, good players. Jerry Robinson was there, Anthony Griggs, Reggie Wilkes, and Joel Williams were the starting linebackers at that time. Good players. But I came in the rookie camp and Jerry had a bad shoulder, so I was behind them. But, you know, the interesting thing is when I first came to camp, went through the 6 weeks, I ended up, when I first came to camp, there was 30 linebackers for 7 positions. And once I came into camp, you know, you just went to work every day. And, you know, little by little, I ended up being the last rookie left. And there was 8 linebackers left. They only kept 7. So they were thinking of keeping 8 the last week of camp. Thought I played well. Went. They said, go home. If you don't get a call, you made the Eagles. So I went home. You wait and wait. Didn't get the call. I get in my Delta ADD, still thinking I made the team. Drive to Philadelphia, walk into the locker room, and Harry Gamble was the player personnel. He said, Mike, go get your playbook, which means you're gone. And, you know, it's interesting is we were at the vet then. So you had to walk down. Of course, I had the last locker on the right-hand side. So I walk all the way down. And I noticed all the guys looking at me and then turning their backs to me. But I knew all the guys. Not that they didn't like me. There was reality to them. You know, this is it. You could be the one getting cut. So I took my playbook. They said, listen, we had a lineman hurt. We want to bring you back. Go home, work out. We're going to find a way to bring you back. So I went home 1 week, running, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, running. Now 4 weeks, I'm like, this isn't happening. So this is it. What do I do now? You know, kind of was coming to terms with my life. Packed up my stuff. I had never stopped running till that point. I stopped running and I just said, I got to move on. So I went home, and as I was pulling up to my house, my mom said, the Eagles just called. They want you back. So got in my car, went back, and I said, I'm going to never let them cut me again. And so first game, they put me on all the special teams. We played Washington down in Washington, and we kicked the ball 6 times, and I had 6 special teams tackles. So in 1 week, I was the leading special teams tackler, which kind of solidified my position. But then it made me the enemy of everybody on special teams because now I was the special teams tackler, leading tackler. So it didn't bode well. But, you know, they welcomed me back. And you know, it was just a start to my career. So
how did you eventually slide into a starting linebacker role?
Well, Jerry had a bad shoulder and he was looking to get out because he really wasn't a middle linebacker. He wanted to play outside. He didn't like getting beat up in the middle there. And he was a great player and a great athlete and just a charismatic guy, just a really nice guy. But I knew he was looking to get out of there, but he had a bad shoulder. And so during the games, he started getting injured. Shoulder started hurting. So I would go in. So I'm playing half the games now. So they kind of slated it in. They saw that I could play and they thought, okay, we can kind of, they got rid of Jerry. Jerry got traded, I think, to the Raiders then to go play outside. And that's when I stepped into the starting role my second year.
Did you feel comfortable right away as a starter?
Yeah. I mean, we were in a 34 defense, you know, so for me, it was, you know, you headbutting guards, going to the football and making plays. And I was getting better at pass coverage because those things, you had to cover the tight end a lot and backs. So you had to have, you know, good technique there. The scheme was good, but it was more of a bend, don't break. So, you know, we kind of like the teams would drive and then get within the 20. And there's so many guys in coverage, you couldn't score. So we were on the field a long time, but it bode well for my, you know, how I played linebacker. It was a good match. So
you talked about the 6 tackles on special teams. Was that like the moment you felt like you arrived and belonged?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. You kind of have to come into it. I had a saying one time, it said, think like a rookie, play like a pro, you know, play like you've been there, and you have to go in and you have to get those stars out of your eyes quick. Because I remember my rookie year, I had posters on my wall of Jack Lambert. He was the guy, Pittsburgh Steelers. So my rookie year, we go out and play the Steelers, and there's Jack Lambert. It was his last year, 20 yards away from me, and I'm looking at him. I'm going, that's him. So I went over and I introduced myself to him. I don't know if anybody knows Jack Lambert, but he's he was pretty nasty. He was a pretty mean, and I mean, he just was. Joe Green says he was one of the meanest people he ever met. And he said some choice words for me as a rookie and said, get away from him. But he was still intense and he was just a great player. But you know, you have to get those stars out of your eyes and go, I'm here, you know, I can play with these guys. You have to go in with that confidence because it's just hard work. You just got to work through all those things. It's crashing through those quitting points in the training that you realize when you get there, it's just about executing, you know, and not, I always tell players, I say, don't make mistakes. You got to know what you're doing and don't get injured. Those are the big things. You got to stay out of the tub, stay on the field. So, but yeah, you kind of have to get rid of that pretty quick or you don't stay long.
So your first couple of years, Marion Campbell, as we mentioned, and you mentioned 3-4, bend but don't break. Then a guy named Buddy Ryan comes to town in 1986 and probably the antithesis of bend, don't break, constantly attacking, taking the fight to the offense. I mean, obviously you knew Buddy because the Bears had won the Super Bowl, but when you first get a look at the defense in the playbook, was it completely 180 from what you had been doing? Is it that tangible?
Yeah, 180. I don't even know if it explains it. It's totally he came in and he said to me, he looked at all the film of all the guys and evaluate everybody. We didn't know this, of course, but he was doing this and he invited me in. So this is off season. He calls me in. I have my first meeting with him. He said, Mike, he said, I like the way you play. He goes, I think you're going to be our signal caller. He goes, and you'll be our captain. He goes, but I'm going to tell you this right now. He said, you have to come in the best shape of your life. He said, because if you're going to lead this team, he said, I'm going to try and kill them. He said, I'm going to run them till they can't run anymore. And he goes, whoever falls, I'm going to get rid of them. And he said, so I can't have you fall, you know? And he said to me, well, that's what this is how he finished the conversation. He said, if I can't change my people, I will change my people. That was his saying. And I thought, oh no. So I went home and started running more and dropped weight. You know, you had to get, and you just saw it was a different type of defense. So he gave me, this is the off season again. He gives me a hand. He gives me a playbook. And of course it was a thick, you know, but what it was, he had, what he would do was he had the game plan. He would have every defense he could run across the top of the game plan. He'd have every formation the offense could run on the left side, and he created a chart. And he said, if they come out in this formation and I call 46, I want this coverage. If I call 46 blitz, I want this blitz. If I call AFC, I want this coverage. If I call AFC blitz, I want this coverage. Now, if they come out in this formation and I call this, and that's what it was. You had to memorize all that because everything happened on the field. All he would say is 46 coverage, 46 blitz, 4-3, 4-3 coverage, 4-3. And I had to look at what they came out in and then plug in what he had on that sheet. And of course, then they would shift. Now that would change what he had on that. So again, it was memorizing. So I took that home and I'm memorizing. It was just, I couldn't understand what it all was. And he brings me in the next day and he throws the video on. He says, 46 covers, 46 blitz. And God had blessed me with the ability to memorize. So I just started spitting them out. And he said, okay. I thought, man, I passed. He goes, here's another game plan. Here's a video. Come in tomorrow. I was like, oh, no. So he did that for about a week. And then I got the calls and he said, okay. So we came into camp and he was for sure. He did exactly what he said. He, oh, my goodness. He ran us till and really challenged us. And a lot of things I take away from what he taught us there. I mean, a lot of it was crazy, but the good things that I took away was some of the things that he taught us that, you know, of the focus and the attention to detail and things like that, that you had to apply to your life. It was a good, you know, there was a give and take always with good and bad, but he was an intense coach, no doubt.
Do you remember the first time you felt like the defense clicked under Buddy, the first game where you guys were flying?
It was tough the whole first year because everyone had to study and you had to know the calls. So the confusion was that if every player wasn't on the same page, you would have that confusion and you couldn't have it out there. So everybody wasn't studying that first year and it wasn't work. You know, we'd be double covering one guy and one guy'd be wide open and we'd have one, you know, and guys, so, you know, because all the yelling on the field. So you had to, when they came out in the line of scrimmage, I had to get the front set and then I had to turn to the DBs and get the coverage set. So I said to Buddy, I come to the sideline, I said, Buddy, not everybody's studying. They don't know the calls. He goes, that's why I have you out there. I'm like, oh no. So it took time, but you did start to see it. I mean, you could see glimpses of it. Like when Buddy was so funny. We went to play for a week. We went to work out with the Lions because we were going to play a preseason game with them. So we go up there for a week And during the practices with the Lions, he didn't run any of the 46 because he didn't want them to know, because it was kind of new. Only the Bears ran it. Nobody knew how real, how to block it, what, where it was coming from. And so we didn't run the 46. We'd just run the 4-3, 4-3, 4-3. And then after practice, the Lions would go in. We'd run the 4-6. So we had to stay out into another practice. So preseason game, we run all 46 when we play them, and we're just killing the quarterback. We're just sacking them and hitting them and hitting them and hitting them. And he just was making a statement. Here we come. And so even through the first year, but you started to see it by midseason, it started to come together. You could see it. And then it was plugging in different players. You know, you had Seth Joyner come back. He had gotten cut. They brought him back. And then just different players that started to plug in, you know, Reggie and Clyde and Jerome and all the guys up front. Just you could see it's going to be a great defense. So
time for a break on One-on-One. We will have more with former Eagles linebacker Mike Reichenbach in just a few moments. But right now, there's nothing quite like the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid when it comes to exhilarating efficiency. With hybrid technology and thrilling capability, these vehicles deliver an electrifying performance on every drive. Discover for yourself what truly makes these hybrids special. Redefine your driving experience with Honda, KBB.com's best value brand of 2020. Contact your local Honda dealer today about the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid. And now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's return to our conversation with former Eagles linebacker Mike Reichenbach. When is the game when you realized that you guys were going to be good? Because that first year was rough. The second year, you were close to 500. Or that was a strike year, if I'm not mistaken. So it was kind of all over the place. And then you guys break through.
Yeah, what happened was, I think the strike kind of brought us together. And we actually, you know, of course, you know, I used to have to pick up the playbook. We weren't supposed to, all this stuff, but had to go get it. And then we had to have our own practices. And so we were out practicing, and it kind of brought us together, and we started having fun. I mean, it was kind of like we knew what was going on, the strike and all this stuff, but we kind of were like, before that, we were kind of, everybody was so focused on their individual job because it was so intense that you had to, you know, everybody depended on each other to do their job for the whole scheme to work. You couldn't have any individuals. It had to be like everyone working together, doing their job. And it all meshed then. And we kind of saw that as we kind of just had fun running around and saying, hey, you understand why we're doing, we had chances to talk about it and kind of mesh. So when we came back from the strike, we actually were closer through all of that. So it actually was a good thing for us.
What was it like? Because right around now is where Randall Cunningham starts to emerge. You know, I think his first year, that plan where he would come in, Ron Jaworski would quarterback first and second down, and Randall would come in on third down and basically go make a play and see what happens, which is a very difficult way to quarterback football. But being on the other side, on the same team, but from a defensive standpoint, what was it like to see that in real time? Because I think young people today, boy, do I sound old, but they don't appreciate how explosive and how different it was to have a player doing what Randall did, because there are so many guys that are similar now that's become, I don't want to say boring, but it's not unusual to see guys that do what Lamar Jackson, all these guys can do. But Randall, he was a unicorn when he first came out.
Yep. That's for sure. And it's something that you recognize that Randall was one of the first guys that did those kind of things that he kind of gets lost in the shuffle of it all because you see it so prevalent now. But back then, and it was confusing for us. It was hard because we struggled on offense because, of course, Buddy pretty much in the draft, wherever it was, he went defensive. And then kind of, he almost made offense like, if you couldn't play defense, we're going to put you on offense. He was like, but, you know, we did get some guys in there and the offense kind of gelled, but it was just so hard because it was three and out. So we spent a lot of time on the field. And then with Randall coming in, and then Ron played part of this first couple plays, and then bringing Randall in, and it just was confusing. But once you saw what he could do and opened up that aspect that Buddy used to say to Randall, he'd say, Randall, look at your first receiver, maybe at your second receiver. If they're not open, run. because it was so hard to tackle him. And even when you would get a shot at him, you didn't know he had that ability to, he was so wiry that he could bounce like he did Giants game where he bounced off the linebacker and kind of just his legs got kicked up, landed back on his feet and kept running and just changed the game. And we could see it that it was going to be, it was exciting. But we tended to, I don't know if we surrounded him with enough ability, talent, which still had made him the central guy, and they started keying in on him. But yeah, we just never had that offense that could, you know, score enough points. We would always hold their offense to minimal points, but we always struggled in that. But Randall made it a lot of very exciting.
One of the high water marks was you guys win the division in 88 and end up winning or end up going to the Fog Bowl in Chicago. I'm very curious. Because I remember I was in eighth grade and I was so excited to watch that game because that was the first Eagles playoff game since I had been a fan. And then the fog rolls in and I felt cheated as a fan because like I'd been waiting for this for so long. What was it like in the moment on the field? Like, was it as difficult to see as it was on TV? Was it a little better in real time or was it just a guessing game?
Yeah, it was difficult. I mean, we were out in Arizona the week there before because it was so cold here that we went out there to practice. And then prior to the game, flew back into Chicago the day before, and all of a sudden this heat wave hits Chicago. This temperature had gone up and the hot air hit that lake and it just started fogging. I remember the game started and we were on the sidelines and you look to the end of the field, the stadium, and the smoke, it was like a horror film. The smoke just started billowing down the steps. I thought the stadium was on fire because it was that thick. And within minutes, it rolled into the stadium and you couldn't see. So the officials blow the whistle. So they're going down to the end zone. So Buddy says, go down and find out what they're doing. So I went down the end zone and I said, well, what are we going to do? So they're looking all the way down the field. And they said, I said, well, what are we looking for? And they said, if we can see the other goalposts, we can play. So I looked down the field and I said, well, can you see it? And they said, sure, we can see it. I'm going, oh, boy, here we go. So you could probably see maybe 15 yards, but it was still very, you couldn't see very clear much further than that. So the game changed because number one, there was stuff going on the field that wasn't, that would have normally been penalties, but it hurt Randall because what the Bears did was Randall was never a loved stepping up in the pocket. He loved getting deep in the pocket and then being able to go escape to the outside or begin to escape to the outside and then cut up inside. And what they did is they took their two defensive ends, Dent and Hampton, and brought them up the field far, right up the field to keep him in the pocket, which made Randall kind of step up now, but you really couldn't see a lot. So it hurt our game plan a lot offensively, but we also dropped a few balls. We got inside the 20 and we just didn't get the ball in the end zone a couple of times, and that hurt us. You know, just guys that usually don't drop balls dropped them. But yeah, it was one of those games we were kind of snake bitten. It is a shame.
And you mentioned holding and all, you know, with the fog and all. One of the things I was always curious of, and I'll ask you this, was there ever any thought of let's send 15 guys out there and see if they notice and just see how far, see what you can get away with. And then, you know, if they call you on it, oh, there was confusion. We didn't know we had two sets of linebackers out there. Sorry about that. Was there any talk of the heck with it? Let's give this a try. Not necessarily that, but see how far you could push it given the extraordinary circumstances.
Matt, you might get a call from the NFL as a coach. They might want to pull you in as a coach because you know what? That's a great thought, but no one ever thought that far. I think we were just, yeah, we were trying to overcome the immediate. I mean, there was just like, okay, because everything had to change. You know, you had to change your, you know, even the what, okay, what are they doing? What were they game planning? What were they doing? Now the game changed. But it was more helped us defensively because the Bears, McMahon was the quarterback, I think, at the time. I think it was McMahon, but he had gotten hurt and they would bring somebody.
I think Tomczak
came in, but they really had to run the football, which now played to us because the 46, you could stuff, but it hurt us offensively. It really took away things that we were going to do, I think, offensively. And of course, the Bears defense, they were the strong part. I mean, that was the toughest. The offense had the tougher part of the game that game. So it was a defensive game. And now it just got worse because you couldn't see. And Randall, they knew what Randall wanted to do. And they were trying to take him out of the game. you know, his legs.
So what was the feeling afterwards? I mean, it's the end of the season. Did it have a unique feeling because of the circumstances? Where was it? Did you feel like you were cheated? Was it just disappointment? Or where were you? Or was there, we're hitting our peak, we'll be back? Like, where do you remember the locker room in your head being after that loss?
I just think it was disappointing because we definitely thought we were a better we could beat the Bears. I mean, we definitely thought we could. We just thought that we were. And it's not saying we were looking past them, but we had a confidence. And Buddy built that in his players. I mean, it started from early on, like you had said. He would come to when we were in camp, he would go to the offensive huddle and he'd say, listen, I know it's an unwritten rule. You don't cut in practice, you know, chop block. He said, but I'm going to tell you now, you do whatever it takes to block those guys. I don't care if you have to chop block them, do whatever. And if you guys don't block them, I'm going to get rid of you. And then he would come over to the defensive huddle and he'd say, listen, they're going to chop block you. And if you let them chalk block you, I'm going to get rid of you. He was basically setting up a fight. So in camp, they'd come out and they would chop block. And of course, the whistles, guys would start fighting and fight. And, you know, you might have a 20-minute period or 25-minute period. You might get three plays because there would be one play you'd fight and then another play and you'd fight. But he was setting a tone of with the players. You do what it takes. You do whatever it takes. And, you know, that permeated the locker room, a confidence that not a cockiness, but a confidence to say, listen, you know, you don't go out there, you go out there and finish what you start. So we were disappointed. We knew it was an opportunity we missed. I don't think we had a chance to even think about the whole fog and all that. It was just part of the game. You know, they used to try and say this in the weather, whatever it is, it is only a negative thing if you let it be a negative thing, you know, and you have to work around, you know, work through it. So, yeah, but it was disappointing.
So when you think back, because I think you had one more year, you were on the team one more year after that, and you guys had success. And then I think that was the year the Rams came into the vet and beat you guys. They kind of punched you in the mouth with a couple early touchdowns and never were able to. Randall never seemed comfortable and the offense never really hit a stride.
No. Yeah, that was one of the most disappointing games. Now, it was more of that game. I could tell we were not fired up for the game. I think there was, you know, we had hit like you had mentioned earlier, you kind of hit a peak at some point and you start going, okay, we're not getting better or we're not, there was something about that game. It was kind of like you kind of just had a feeling we were not going to do well. And I can't explain it, but I just remember it was like, okay, you were kind of coming to a head. They're like, okay, we might be coming to the end of this, you know, and you could kind of see it. It was, you know, and the fans were getting a little more, you know, we've kind of reached our peak.
It's interesting. You played your entire Eagles career at the vet, and we heard so many nightmare stories about the turf. What was it like to play on that day in, day out? Like, could you notice a difference when you went to Miami your last couple of years, just not having to bang on that turf constantly?
Yeah, the turf was back then. It's not like the turf is now. I mean, it had no give to it. It was like playing on a carpet. And as soon as you stopped your foot, as soon as you planted your foot stopped. It bit, but everything else kept moving. And there were so many guys that knees, ankles, guys hated to come play at the vet. And then there was those ripples where you had any of those stadiums that were 2-1 stadiums, you know, that was the big thing in the league then. You know, you make these all-purpose stadiums. And so baseball played and football, and they used to have to cover those. And there was those ripples in the field, you know, and you guys would trip on them or catch their foot on them. But yeah, and even when it would get, it really was a pad, a foam pad with a carpet over the top. And so when it would get cold, if that pad would get wet and freeze, it was like playing on concrete. And then the turf burns on top of that. Everybody would get the turf burns because which take off layers of your skin. But yeah, it was difficult. But the stadium itself, the atmosphere, the fans, it was incredible to be on that field. I just remember we were playing the Cowboys and it was around Christmas. And of course, they didn't shovel the snow out of the aisleways then. And so the Dallas punter was in the end zone. And he's getting ready to punt the ball. And all you see is these snowballs crashing all around him and splatting it. And your fans just going nuts, screaming. And you're just looking up, looking around, going, wow, this is incredible. But the fans were very good fans. I say they feel one thing about the Eagle fans, whether they cheer you or boo you, they will always show up. Lawrence Taylor used to say to me, Mike, he said, what's wrong with these fans? I said, what's wrong, Lawrence? He said, well, you just walk out in the field for warmups and they're already throwing stuff at you and dumping stuff on you. And I said, Lawrence, they do that to us. I said, that's how they show their love.
Who was the best player you played with during your NFL career?
That's a tough one. There were so many good ones. I mean, Reggie was great. You know, Jerome was good. I mean, Clyde. I mean, all those guys, you know, Seth. And there was just a lot of great players. But, you know, you look at guys when I went to Miami with Dan Marino and guys like that, that just were at another level. I watched the way he just not only played the game, but approached the game. He would work with his receivers. He was the first guy. I mean, you talk about back shoulder passing. I mean, he was doing that before that was even a thing. You know, he worked with Clayton and Duper and those guys, and there was timing. Like he always knew where he was going before the play. He'd just confirm it when he got the ball. He'd look people off, and then he always knew where the mismatches were, and he would work with timing. He would let go the ball go before receivers were in their break. He saw guys like that, and you just went, wow, you were playing with, you know, guys at a different level. They were just that good. And even guys like Lawrence Taylor, some of the guys you played against, I mean, the Giants linebackers and, you know, the Bears defense, you looked at some of those things and you just went, you know, I played against Walter Payton. And I just remember, you know, you just walk out. I was a captain. He was a captain. And he walked out and went to shake his hand and he pulled his hand back and he said, you don't deserve to shake my hand. Of course, it's all a head game. He wants to get in your head. And he's just like, oh, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to get you. And then he would do that jitterbug. And, you know, you're trying to take him out. And he'd do that jitterbug and then go. And he's just so many great players that that you played against, that guys that you never thought you deserved to be on the field with. But it was great, great experience.
How tough was it when you left the Eagles and went to Miami?
It was tough because it's all I ever knew. I was close to home. You know, this was always been my home. I always knew I'd move back here. But George Hill was down in my, remember the coach I told you about, Woody Hayes, he was down Miami and they needed linebackers. And I thought, you know, you go through phases. You go, you want to make the team, then you want to start, and then you want to go to the Super Bowl. You want to get there. And so I thought, well, Miami, Dan Marino, he can get us to the Super Bowl, and they need linebackers. So I went down, but they played to 34. Always a transition. I mean, there's just, but, you know, it's going to work. You got to pick up your lunch pail and put your hard hat on and go to work. But definite different atmosphere. The heat, you had to overcome a different mentality of coaching with Don Shula, where Buddy would say, go tell him, you know, you're going to beat him and tell him how bad you're going to beat him. And Don Shula was like, no, don't tell him, you know, don't give him any ammunition, you know, reserved, keep it quiet, you know, different type of coach, not as intense, but, you know, just the whole transition of life. But that's where it really, you know, I had near the end of my Eagles career, that's where I was starting to search for things. And I kind of stumbled into a Bible study and heard about the gospel and Jesus Christ. And then that I went to Miami and kind of fell away a little bit more because it was, you know, you're just back outside that your comfort zone now. And then, you know, I just kind of hit bottom down there and just kind of turned it around and said, nah, that's it. I'm done. You know, I changed my life and kind of got serious about my faith, started pursuing God and it changed. It was all part of the plan, but yeah, it was, definitely a transition. Now you had to learn about the new, you know, the rivalry. You had the rivalries in Philly. You knew those guys, Cowboys, you know, the Giants, you knew all that growing up. Now it was the Bills, you know, just different teams. So yeah, but it was good though.
And once you talked about, you know, working in sales, you also coached for a long time, Calvert Christian Academy, right?
Yeah. So when I retired and came away, you know, the pastor at our church, I go to Calvary Chapel in Philadelphia. The prayer was that he'd always have a school where he could raise up, you know, godly men and women and go out and change the world. And part of that was we started, you know, we talked about having a football ministry, a ministry of using football to raise up godly men to say, this is what a man of God looks like. And you know, because you always saw football, it was a great sport, but you saw those guys that got left behind, whether they got injured or they weren't good enough and they kind of got left. And then all of a sudden, here's this kid, you know, high school, college, pro, whatever it is, doesn't know who he is because sports became more of a business. You know, it wasn't like something you did in your leisure and you did it because you enjoyed it. It became a business. And now you can see it to its fruition. I mean, they're making, I said, if they ever open the barn door and they're paying college kids, it's going to ruin the game. But, it is. It's a business, and you kind of learn that quick when you get to those levels. But we wanted to use it for something different. So we developed, you know, we set up a mission statement of what it looked like, and we started a team, a middle school team, and then it became a high school team, and I coached there for 21, 22 years. But it was richer for me because, you know, God brought a sinful man there to change his heart. And with the privilege I had of entering into these kids' lives and seeing what they were going through and the struggles they had, it just was a great time. And then God blessed us. And we actually even started making it to the playoffs. And I remember the first year we made it to the playoffs, I was just doing it as a ministry. And our AD came in and said, "Hey, we made the playoffs." I go, "Playoffs? What playoffs?" And he goes, "The state playoffs." I go, "Well, do we have to go?" And he said, "Yeah, you have to go." So we went and started making the playoffs. It was a great, great time. And my son, I got to coach my sons.
Could you have imagined, you know, if I talked to you back when you were playing three sports in high school in Bethlehem, what the next several decades of your life were going to be?
No, it's like one of those things. And I say that to the young people, you know, I say, I said, the greatest thing you got to find is truth. What is truth? There's one truth. Or it's not truth, because can only be one truth. And once you find that, you take one step in the right direction every day. And that, you know, and as you gain information, there's people along the way that I look back and then that God placed in my life at times when I needed some type of input or encouragement, or even, you know, to stop me in my tracks to say, "Yo, you can't do that," you know, to discipline me or to do whatever it was. And you know, you look back and you never get there by yourself, you know, but God has this plan that he has, you know, a providential plan that, you know, he takes you on a journey and you gotta get to the end of yourself and say, "Okay, I've looked in the world for everything that gives value and identity and purpose, but haven't found it." And that's when it came to the knowledge of truth. And then you got to make a decision. Once you make that decision, you start moving in that direction. So for me, yeah, I look back and I can see God in the midst of all of it, but I could have never told you it would have been as rich as what it was, even in the troubles that I had. Because when I walked away from the game, that was my ninth season, I was about $1 million in debt because of my bad decision-making and the people I was hanging with in the game. You know, being on the streets and in the streets I was going out six nights a week. And the people that I was hanging with were not good people and got involved in some business transactions and things that I shouldn't have been involved in that got me in some deep trouble. But once I knew that God was there and he was in the battle with me and I had my wife and my son had been born, and, you know, I'd gotten married before my last year in Miami. My wife had come to Miami with me, and then we had our first son. And then I just knew that it was time. I could feel, you know, God pulling me away. So it was time to go. And so by the time I got to San Francisco, best chance I had to make it to the Super Bowl, best, you know, Joe Montana is there. And then Steve Young took over and Jerry Rice and all the talent. And God just placed it on my heart, said, "It's time to go." And I'm like, "Lord, you know, I'm $1 million in debt. And, you know, I have a chance to go to the Super Bowl now too, you know." And he said, and I was reading in my Bible about David and Goliath, and David charges the battlefield while the rest of the soldiers are standing there. And he's not denying there wasn't a giant there. There were giants. But God said to him, "Am I bigger than your giants, or are your giants bigger than me?" And I thought, "You know what, Lord, you're bigger than my giants." And I stepped away, and one step at a time in the right direction. And he's blessed me abundantly since then and taken my life and made it a miracle. And I could have, people say to me now, I have less money than I had then and all that stuff, but I'm the richest man that in the world right now. I have a wife that, my wife Lynn is just a tremendous, wife and mother. My children, Michael and Josh and Kelly, you know, they're all married, walking with the Lord. I have grandkids now. Just been a rich life.
Mike Reichenbach, thanks so much for the time. This was great.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it, man. Appreciate your time.
And that will do it for this week's episode of One-on-One with Matt Leon, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. Many thanks to Mike Reichenbach for being our guest this week, and also thanks to Steve Switkowitz, who connected me with Mike. Steve's a player marketing representative with an impressive list of clients of former local pro athletes. If you're looking for someone for your event, he can be reached at 610-703-8479, and his email is scwit87@aol.com. You can follow the show on X at @OneOnOnePod. You can follow me on X as well at @MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check us out again next time when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
True North Convenience Stores and Red Bull are an elite matchup. True North offers returning players Red Bull Original and Sugar Free. First round picks like Watermelon, Wild Berries, and the newest rookie, Red Bull Zero. Right now, grab three of your favorite 8-ounce can flavors for $6.50 and save 10 cents off a gallon with the True Rewards mobile app. Available in your favorite app store. Rush into True North to score this deal before the clock runs out. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Quality sleep isn't just about how long, but how well you sleep. And science proves temperature plays a massive role. ChiliPad by SleepMe is a precision temperature-controlled sleep system that cools or warms your bed so you can sleep hard and recover harder. And it's not just for pro athletes. Just set your temp from 55 to 115 degrees, and ChiliPad does the rest. Visit sleep.me and use code SLEEPCOOL20 for 20% off your first ChiliPad. That's SLEEP.me for 20% off your ChiliPad. This special offer expires September 30th and cannot be combined with other offers.